Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
It would never have occurred to my parents that one day they would get to meet the British royal family. Yet that's what did happen 80 years ago, in the summer of 1945, at an event to mark victory over Germany in World War II. My parents were both from the south of Ireland, my father from County Clare, my mother from Dublin. But they had separately gone to work with what was then the National Bank, and had been moved to various parts of the island before and after they met and married in Belfast. On the night of the German Blitz on Belfast, in April 1941, that's where our family was living. I was nearly four, my sister was nine, and my brother just 1 year old. 1,000 people were killed in the city that night. A house 2 doors away from ours took a direct hit. We survived, but our home would not be livable. My mother, my brother and myself caught an overcrowded morning train to neutral Dublin, where we stayed with her parents. My father found a temporary flat with my sister in Belfast. We were all reunited when he was promoted to be a bank manager, first in County Leitrim and then in Derry. I was aware that the war was still going on, but I was too young to know that the sailors I could see in the city streets, including many Americans, and thousands like them, were involved in the vital Battle of the Atlantic, which the Allies eventually won at huge cost in vessels and human lives. The war with Germany ended in May 1945. A few months later, my father was to take a decision as bank manager which offended some of its nationalist customers. As part of a royal victory tour of the UK, the King and Queen and the then Princess Elizabeth paid a visit to Northern Ireland. The visit included Derry, where the Loch Foyle naval base had been hugely important. My father was among a group of local professional and business people who were invited to a garden party in Brook Park. He had no hesitation in accepting the invitation and went there with my mother, even though many nationalists saw the occasion as a paying tribute to a monarchy they resented. As he told me later, the invitation had been an honour for the bank, and he was the bank's representative. However, that a man with his personal history should find himself meeting royals face to face was indeed extraordinary. 25 years earlier, on an infamous November Sunday in Dublin, he had been one of many thousands of spectators in Croke Park who had come to see a Gaelic football match between Dublin and Tipperary. But that afternoon, on what became known as Bloody Sunday, armed British units of black and tans, auxiliaries and police opened fire on spectators and players. 7 people, one of them a player, were killed. 5 more died of their wounds, and 2 were trampled to death in the panic to escape. "I was knocked over in the stampede," said my father, "but I was young and fit. I reckon I was safer on the ground with my hands over my head than on my feet as a target." I was 10 years old when he talked to me about it. His account was brief, vivid, shocking. But his summing up was neither a political message nor a generalisation about the British. There are times when people do very bad things. So, somehow it happened that a survivor of Ireland's first so-called Bloody Sunday came face to face with the British royal family in Derry, a city that was to suffer its own Bloody Sunday in the Troubles a few decades later. My mother, who was with him at the Derry garden party, had had her own encounter with black and tans when she was a 10-year-old child in Dublin. One morning, when her parents were out and she was in charge of younger ones, there was a hammering on the front door. The children were confronted by a group of armed men. The officer in charge demanded to see their uncle, who was a university student lodging with the family. When my mother said he wasn't at home, he demanded to be shown his room. Then came a bizarre twist in the story. While his men clattered past them, the officer escorted the anxious children into the living room and sat down at the piano. He played what he called music hall tunes, unknown to his young audience, and he kept playing amid clumping noises from upstairs. Nothing was found then or later to link their student uncle with anti-British activities, and he eventually became a Harley Street consultant in London. But what stayed most vivid in my mother's memory was not the Black and Tans' invasion of her home, an all-too-common experience for Dubliners at that time, but the decency of one officer who made an effort to comfort frightened children.
For the best part of 10 years, I drove a 35-minute commute to my job at the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation. I joined the Autoroute near my home in French-speaking Fribourg, which soon became the Autobahn in German-speaking Bern. Driving towards Bern when the timing was right, I witnessed the splendour of the sun rising over the Alps. And on my return journey in the evening, I would race the setting sun. At 120 kilometres per hour, I passed forests and hills, undulating farmland, rivers and streams, always in my peripheral vision, remaining unknown. But by the time I left the job, an idea had taken hold in my mind. I wanted to walk my commute. Hiking is sacred in Switzerland. You can walk from any point to any point without ever having to worry about right of way. The country is crisscrossed by 65,000 kilometres of signposted laneways and pathways across all kinds of terrain. On a Saturday morning in May, I set out from home in my brand new hiking boots. I walked uphill towards the forest on the far side of our housing estate. Turning my back on civilization, I walked into the woods and the promise of solitude. Almost one third of the country is covered by forest. Having grown up by the Irish Sea, this is a new world to me, a beautiful, mystical world with ever-changing light and sounds. I had my route printed out on 10 A4 pages. Every page was about an hour's walk, I discovered. The day was dry, the sun never far away, and the route full of variety. I ate a sandwich on a bench overlooking a field of barley in Heitenried at around 12 o'clock. I crossed the River Sense by the covered bridge at Sodbach. The first half of the walk went smoothly, and it was only a quarter past two when I got to the small town of Schwarzenburg, where I had planned to spend the night. I went to a cafe, ordered a beer, and studied my maps. My boots were bothering me a little bit, but a few plasters were keeping things under control, and I felt fit and well. How hard could it be to do another 18 kilometres? There was only one way to find out. So I cancelled the B&B and walked out of town, up another hill and into another forest. When I wasn't on forest or river trails, I was walking along the edges of fields of corn, wheat, potatoes and turnips. Suspicious cows and sheep watched me go by, not approving of my presence. It made a nice change from cars and trucks. The wooden farmhouses I passed were hundreds of years old, in the local vernacular style, with deep eaves and roof shingles. The barn and living quarters were housed under one roof, with a ramp leading up to the hayloft, so a cart could drive straight up. Though the style has been refined over the centuries, it has essentially stayed the same since the 1300s. Every house had its orchards, its showcase vegetable garden. That continuity and the relative peace that came with it is the essential difference between Swiss and Irish landscape. The Swiss relationship with their land is one of stability and harmony. There is none of the trauma that lies under the surface in the Irish countryside. No whispers from the ghosts of the dispossessed. Things took a turn for the worse at Schwarzwasserbrücke, a railway stop on a provincial line. Another break, this time in the back garden of an enormous old guest house, the only building at the stop. I finished my tea and crisps and stood up to leave. While I'd been sending texts and double-checking the maps, my body had decided this was the moment to mount a serious protest. Everything from my lower back down was stiff and aching, the pain in my feet almost unbearable. Bent over and wincing, I hobbled out onto the road. I looked longingly at the station platform, but turned to carry on. If all went well, I would reach my destination, my old workplace, in 2 hours. Impossible to stop now. I trudged on for another 2.5 hours, muscles and blisters hurting at every step. But my pace had slowed and I never did make it to the office. When I reached the outskirts of Bern, I saw a city bus and I realised the game was up. I bought a ticket from the machine, the best 2 francs I ever spent. Later, I sat at the bus terminal in the suburb of Könitz, with the last rays of sun keeping me warm until my lift arrived. I didn't mind that I hadn't completed my mission to the letter. It was the spirit of the thing. I had paid homage to the land and tested myself. I was ready to move on.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'.
On a spring morning, arriving early to avoid the crowds, a young Dutch couple enters the Richelieu wing of the Louvre Museum. Martin, a baby-faced 20-year-old, is hopelessly overdressed. His wife, Opian, 2 years older, struggles to hide a smile at his flashy attire. This journey is not their honeymoon, or even their anniversary. By now, they have been married for nearly 400 years. Martin and Opian, or rather Rembrandt's full-length portraits of Martin and Opian, have come to Paris because they have been jointly acquired in a unique collaboration between the Dutch and French governments. Speaking on Dutch Radio 1, the director of the Rijksmuseum, Wim Peebs, likens the paintings to a pair of shoes, never to be separated. For years, the portraits of Martin Sulmans and Opian Coppet had hung together in the bedroom of Baron Eric de Rothschild. When the Baron finally decided to sell, both the Louvre and the Rijksmuseum balked at the asking price, a mere 80 million euro apiece. The solution? The Rijksmuseum purchased Martin, the Louvre, Opian. There was one stipulation: the paintings must always be exhibited together. And so began a new partnership. After enduring the necessary indignity of restoration, Martin and Opian would spend 5 years together in Amsterdam, the next 5 in Paris, and forever travel back and forth between the two cities, a lifestyle befitting the high-status couple they once were. At the time Rembrandt painted these portraits, his own love story was unfolding. In 1634, he married Saskia van Ulleberg. He was a miller's son, she a burgomaster's daughter. Despite the disparity in social standing, the marriage appears to have been a happy one. What can the artist have thought of his rich young sitters with their trendy lace collars and glitzy accessories? It's tempting to imagine he must have painted Martin's flounces and Opian's artificial mole or mouche with his tongue held firmly in his cheek. Martin's pose is filled with swagger. One hand rests on his hip, conveniently affording us an excellent view of his expensive black cloak. His white collar reaches below his shoulders and is mirrored by the extravagant ruffles on his garters. Most marvellous of all are his shoes. He treats us to a full frontal of one foot, a side profile of the other. Sumptuous rosettes the size of dinner plates adorn the buckles. The sheen of polished black leather is set off by silver-grey stockings encasing a pair of well-formed calves. He seems unembarrassed by the height of his heels. Opian turns towards Martin, one foot forward, as though she is about to step out of her frame to join him. She holds her ostrich fan at the ready, should she need to hide her blushes at her husband's ostentation. Her collar, her black dress, form a kind of symmetry with his outfit. But the subtle lustre of her pearls, the dignity of her poise, to me convey class as well as wealth. The shoe, half visible beneath her skirts, is made of grey leather and adorned with a rosette a fraction the size of her husband's. If Martin's footwear speaks loudly of new money, Opian's more modest choice could perhaps be seen to emphasise her noble lineage. Martin Sulmans was the son of a Belgian immigrant who owned a sugar refinery in Amsterdam. The sugar trade at the time was notoriously dependent on slave labour. On Dutch-owned plantations in Brazil, the native Tupi people were routinely exploited and abused. After 8 years of marriage, Martin died, and Opian assumed his share in the refinery. 5 years later, she took a second husband, Martin Day, a man who had spent time in the colonies where he was known for his sadistic behaviour. Opian performed administrative duties for him throughout their marriage, so surely must have known all about the disturbing source of their shared wealth. The fashionable young couple settling into their new home in the Louvre know nothing of the tumultuous life events to come. For them, time stopped on the day Rembrandt painted their portraits. In the intervening centuries, they have never been parted. And now their future is assured. Thanks to the intervention of a Dutch Prime Minister and a French President, this pair of shoes will always stay together.
Most days in Limerick, my temporary and beloved home, I was inside grey skies, a grid of buildings, and strangers under hoods and umbrellas who could be friends, but were not yet. We rushed by in our haste to get warm and dry, to get food and drink, to get drunk and flirt with someone, anyone. I also lived across the street from the Shannon River, so wandered the boardwalk, with a vagabond's hope for a heron or swan to claim me, swooping me up across the water. The Shannon is a tidal river, surging at 4 knots on the ebb. High tides can reach 17 feet under a full moon and high winds. I tracked its rise and fall, and its current, quiet or quick, and understood in my river-keeping, time was a current. But this current was more than a metaphor. People lost and at their ends, booze, drugs, unemployment, heartbreak, and feeling forgotten in this post-Celtic tiger Ireland. Men, mostly men, and mostly young, took their own lives in the Shannon. 2 men in 1 month, right in front of my house. My landlady explained that for a few years, right after the 2008 crash, it was particularly bad. It's gotten better, she said. Not as many, not as often. But what is better when it comes to suicide? One morning, while I was drinking tea in bed, still holding onto the night's warmth, a helicopter churned loud and low over the river. Boats and fire trucks raced into view. News flashed on my feed. Emergency services have been deployed to a river rescue following the report of an individual entering the River Shannon this morning. I watched at the window, hands pressed to the cold pane, and remembered, as I prayed, a long ago November night in college, when I jumped into a half-frozen lake and was saved by campus security. How I swam away from their dinghy, how I fought their hands and kindness, how I longed to disappear underwater, to stay alone in my aloneness, how a burly officer dove in and hooked his arm around my neck as if catching the saddest, angriest sea monster. No, I said. No, no, no. Yes, he said. Yes, yes, yes. When we reached shore, I shivered with a sudden tooth-chattering violence, but felt, too, how I was being returned to the world. I remember the moon, so bright and distant in that dark sky, and the officer whispering, "We'll get you warm. Help is coming." And the odd flash of recognition when I walked alone at night along the Shannon, a keening toward that old despair. How easy to jump into that current. I searched instead for the swans paddling in the moonlight, as if my searching for them mattered. One late night, I walked around the river, crossing over its bridges, circling the dark, circling my ordinary loneliness, circling my way to compromise. Keep moving, don't stop. Keep moving, don't stop. I leaned against the river railing and watched a swan paddle through the dark water. Ghost bird. A man and woman on bicycles and wearing bright yellow vests pedaled up and stopped. Quiet, gentle smiles. The Limerick Suicide Watch. "How's your evening?" the man asked. "Grand," I said. "Just watching the swans." "You okay out here by yourself?" the woman asked. "Oh," I said, "just walking." The answer was no, and the answer was yes, and I knew I'd keep walking and would be in bed soon, would not be in the river, because I could see that was what they feared, because the man was searching my face, and the woman seemed to be watching my hands that gripped the railing. "It's just that we noticed you've been walking around the river for a while now, so," the man said. How many people had they missed? How many people had they found who might have been thinking, "This, this, this, now, now, now"? And how many had they saved? And could I be the counterweight to the many they had not? I saw their worry and decided not to worry them unnecessarily. "Thank you," I said. "It's a lovely night. No rain. But now I'm on my way back home to bed." They smiled, waiting on their bikes, and I saw they were hoping I'd walk on. And so I did.
In this proud land, we grew up strong. We were wanted all along.
It seems strange to think of it now, but when I was a student in Trinity in the early 1950s, very few people travelled abroad. So it caused some surprise when I decided to take a trip to Germany on my motorbike, a Royal Enfield 350. To travel to Germany as a civilian, so close to the end of the war, required visas, and identification was frequently asked for. Several letters had to be sent out to various German universities. In particular, to the chairman of the German Amateur Athletic Association. He then kindly invited me to stay as a thank you for acting as the team's interpreter after I had run against Germany's 400-metre champion. What to take for a 6-week trip in my 2 pannier bags and a rucksack? No crash helmet, as they didn't exist, but a pair of Mark 6 ex-Air Force goggles and a rainproof boiler suit for when it was wet. I felt like an explorer about to penetrate the great unknown. I knew that I would have enough to eat for 3 days, as my mother had prepared 3 different lots of sandwiches, all wrapped in lettuce leaves to keep them fresh. I sailed from Belfast to Hesham and thence to Harwich to spend my first night in an old-fashioned railway hotel. Up early next day to catch the ferry to the Hook of Holland, and then I was on my way. My first shock was a small Dutch town near the German border, where I hoped to get some petrol. I rode all around it and saw nobody. The entire town was in ruins, with not one building left standing. I soon noticed that wherever I went, my motorbike was the subject of much admiration, primarily because it was one of the first after the war to have a chrome finish, unseen in Germany, where I had expected to see far greater modernity. Travel on the autobahns was mostly large juggernauts with 2 trailers. But what surprised me most was how primitive many of the smaller towns were. There was cow dung on the roads, very few cars or trucks, and most of the tradesmen using 4-wheel drays. On the street, people wore sombre expressions as they made their way through the debris of the towns. Not that I could blame them. It was to be another 2 years before Erhard, the German Wirtschaftswunder, managed to revivify and rebuild the German coal and steel industries. I drove on through the Black Forest to the city of Villingen, and then on to Iserlohn, where I was taken to a big athletics conference and dinner, and presented with a pair of the latest Adidas spikes. On to Minster, where I saw a superb outdoor performance of The White Horse Inn, a musical comedy. After the performance, about 80% of the audience left, leaving behind about 100 men who rose with their crutches and single remaining legs. At that moment, I understood completely why my father had always refused to speak about his experiences in the trenches during World War I. Coming to Karlsruhe, I had to cross the Rhine by ferry, as the bridge hadn't yet been rebuilt. I got chatting to the ferryman en route when he admired my motorbike. I then discovered, to my amazement, that he had been second in command of the U-boat which had dropped Sir Roger Casement off the Kerry coast in 1916. Ever onwards towards a small 4-bedroom village in Unterkirnach. There I met another guest who told me that she and her 2 sisters had all lost their husbands just 3 weeks before the end of the war. I was now in the French zone, the area allocated to the control of the French following Germany's collapse. Not unreasonably, having lived under the iron and fearsome rule of the Gestapo, the French made life for the German citizenry as difficult and distasteful as possible. The exception were doctors, who would be held in high regard as their clients often included French soldiers. The following day I met the local doctor, Hans, and his wife, Bethle. She had worked with him as a nurse on the Russian front. Hans and Bethle had been working under the most appalling conditions, often for 15 hours a day. Operations were frequently performed without drugs, and the screams of the wounded were the perpetual background to their work. Hans had returned home to find that his first wife and two of his children had been killed in an air raid, and the house totally destroyed. Soon after, he and Bethle married, essentially so she could care for his remaining children. Hans was in his 50s, and she in her 20s. But situations like this were by no means unusual after the war, where marriages were often a result of practical need. Bethle herself was lovely to look at. Her eyes expressed her emotions, and even today I can still feel their warmth. It sounds extraordinary to say so, but it was love at first sight. And so began a romance, approved by all, including Hans, incredible as that may sound, as it brought to her the joy of young love which had passed her by. It was an intense affair, an innocent Irish boy and a beautiful German girl. We spoke French between us, la langue d'amour. The Black Forest is singularly beautiful and interspersed with lakes, hills and valleys. We drove for miles on my motorbike, took picnics and swam in the lakes. But as the weeks went by, we found ourselves immersed in the slough of despond as reality dawned. Soon I'd have to return to Ireland to go back to Trinity. Finally, the day came when I had to leave my lovely Bethle. I shook hands with Hans, who said to me, "Thank you, Alan, for being here. I want to give you my copy of Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls, and it has the dirt of Stalingrad on its cover." Bethle and I didn't kiss each other goodbye. We just hugged each other for long minutes. I've never thought of myself as being the emotional type, but tears came to my eyes. I started my motorbike and drove away. After a few miles, I stopped by the side of the road and wept.
Bei der Kaserne vor dem großen Tor steht ne Laterne und steht sie noch davor. Da wollen wir uns wiedersehen, bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen.
Dancing with Thierry Thunong. When he comes to dance in the hospital, Blanche is 90 years old, back straight as bamboo, a scarf of indigo blue roses around her throat. His cheekbones and brown eyes call up memories of warriors and his father's ancestors from Vietnam. He dances around the day room on muscular springy legs. But she sees the first greys in his shiny straight hair when she takes his hand to read his palm. He asks her to dance. She tries, still holding a stick in her right hand, left hand clutching his arm, her slippered feet stutter along. The other residents and staff watch, attentive as swallows on a wire. Thierry leads a waltz, his cushiony cheek against her moth-thin skin. There's music, a woman singing in French. Thierry cradles Blanche in his arms and begins to spin, slow at first, then rapidly. She lies back entranced, one willowy arm trails through currents of air. She smiles, a moon in winter reflecting the faraway sun. Thierry goes down on one knee like a knight. She perches on his knee. Their foreheads kiss. embodied in that day room, Shakti and Shiva, beyond thought, beyond age. But the dance must end. Thierry walks her back down the institutional corridor to her room. Her head bows towards her slippers. "What's going on, Blanche?" A moment of hesitation. Then she whispers, "Je t'aime."
On today's Sunday Miscellany, we heard Royals and Bloody Sunday by Dennis Toohey. Clara D brought us Walking My Commute. And from Barbara Leahy, we had Rembrandt's Shoes. Also in there was River Keeper by Kerry Neville. Motorcycle Diaries, Germany 1951, was by Alan Cook. And Dancing with Thierry Thunang was a poem by Lanny O'Handon. Music this morning was I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside, played by Keith Nichols. These Boots Are Made for Walking, of course, sung by Nancy Sinatra. Pachelbel's Canon in D Major was performed by the Taverner Players and conducted by Andrew Parrott. Sinead O'Connor and Willie Nelson sang Don't Give Up, that's by Peter Gabriel. And Lillian Marlane was by Marlena Dietrich. That poem by Lanny O'Hanlon too was the winner of this year's Gary O'Donoghue International Poetry Competition. And Lanny will be reading it at an event in Cork Arts Theatre next Saturday. That's the 17th of May at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's all part of Cork International Poetry Festival, which is running all this week. You can see corkpoetryfest.net for full details. Meanwhile, Barbara Leahy has a new novel out too. It's called Rembrandt's Promise and it's published by Bonnier Books. And following on from Kerry Neville's piece, just to mention that Ireland's suicide prevention charity Pieta has a free 24-hour, 7-day-a-week helpline for anyone who needs support. The number is 1800 247 247 or cpieta.ie. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, the producer of the programme, Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.